start remembering what you hear.
Well, hi out there, and welcome to...
And now, the world's foremost authority.
What's up? This is the Top Lore Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie, also known as Instructora Esperta. Yes, it happened. Bachizada was about a month ago, and I don't know. I mean, I knew this is coming, and it was a really good event, and now that, like, a month has passed, I definitely don't feel any different. It's really weird to put the belt on, but I'm very privileged and I'm honored to finally become this. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm supposed to say something, because this is now my show, and lots of people listen to it, and I guess I'm somewhat of significance in capoeira, especially with the show, but yeah, I just feel like I should have said, I should say something about it. Yeah, I don't know, I just want to keep growing and keep getting better, and I want to keep giving episodes, and with that, we are in our third season, which is crazy. It's really weird to think that we started 3 years ago in my friend's living room, and I just decided that people should listen to different people's stories. I think that everybody has somewhat of a same type of main idea about capoeira. It brought us into this community, and we love it, and we can't help but think that we want to be with it forever and in the community, but everybody has like a different way of how they went about and different journeys, and hopefully we can just keep giving you those stories, and we can get better, and we can keep growing. So anyways, that is that. Before we get to that, let's hear some events. All right, starting with Capoeira Resistencia under Mesa Panao in Richmond, Virginia, October 7th to 9th. Capoeira Luanda under Conde Mestre Esquilo in Austin, Texas, October 15th. Cordal Jiu-Jitsu Perth in Western Australia, October 15th. The ICAP Tournament and Kumite in Culver City on October 15th. And then the week after, Capoeira Makulele under Mestre Fran in Decatur, Georgia, October 20 to 23rd. And Ajay Capoeira Tucson, Arizona under Graduado Sombra, October 20 to 23rd. And finally, Cordal Jiu-Jitsu Los Angeles Bachizado in Hollywood under Instructor Cozinero, October 20 to 23rd. So, if you're at any parts of the globe, you can find a capoeira event if you just throw a stone out there. So, those are the events. Hopefully, you can at least check one of those out. Moving on, this episode is with my good friend and teacher, Professor Guatambu from United Capoeira Association, also known as UCA. He teaches out in LA Silver Lake, Atwater Village area. We taped this earlier, I think late 2015 or early 2016. Like, I don't really remember, but I really liked it. I whenever I have to edit these things, it's like a fun fact that I throw at least 2 to 3 different tantrums before I have to sit down and do post-production. And with this one, it was just super seamless because he is just really charismatic and just very engaging and articulate. And I really just enjoyed letting him go on the mic and just what he said. And I love having to re-listen to these things because I just forget how much great information and knowledge that these teachers have. So yeah.
My name is Michael Gregory Gonzalez Davis in Capoeira. The nickname that has stuck of many is Guatambu. And today I teach in Los Angeles, general Los Angeles area, specifically in Silver Lake, Atwater Village, and Glendale. And I've been doing that now 10 years.
How'd you get your name?
Yeah, What does it mean?
Well, I wish I had a better story, but I reminded my teacher. So my teachers are Mestre Acordeon, Mestre Han, and Master Suelli, all under the same roof. And I was in Berkeley, where their headquarters were at the time, training there. And Mestre Han gave me the name Guatemu. That was the first nickname I got. It took like a year and a half for me to get a nickname. They just kept calling me by my regular name, Michael, whatever. And then finally, he started calling me Guatambu, and then Mestre Acordeon started calling me Shakespeare, and then he started calling me Galán, and then he started calling me Pena Boca, and then he was Frankenstein. I had a really bad haircut, and he said when I did my Jenga, I looked like Frankenstein. But then Guatambu was the one that just kept sticking, and so I asked Mestre Han about it, and he said, oh yeah, well, you know, Guatambu is a kind of wood for beating ball, but that's not why I gave it to you. I gave it to you because there was this guy at my academy down in Brazil whose family had a farm, and on their farm grew a lot of Guatambu, and he'd always show up with all this Guatambu for us to make birimbau. So I get to meet this guy, even though I've been to Mestre Han school down there. I don't think that Guatambu still trains. So that's how I got my name.
No, so tell me about your life, like your parents, and like where did you actually, because you moved here, you're from up north?
Correct. And then even from further, so I was born in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And then I lived the first few years of my life there. I don't know exactly how many. I think around the age of two, my dad and my mom were there with me. My dad felt, he's American, my mom's from Brazil, Bahia, living in Rio at that time. And they met here, actually at USC. That's how they got together, when she was in school and he was there too, in school. And my dad principally felt that there just weren't the economic prospects that he felt he could have if he came back to the States, so they resolved to go back to the States, and they moved back to the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and I grew up there with my mom, was living, it was very different for her there, because my family in Brazil is pretty darn big. My mom is one of six sisters, and they're all, my family is also super tight. Many people will say that, like, oh, as an example, a place in the world, Brazil is a place in the world where folks, you know, have like tight family units. And then Brazilians say our family is even tight compared to other Brazilian families. So we have a really cool thing that way. And so when she moved to the Bay Area, she moved away from like everybody, even more, it was even more different than when she came here to the United States for school and stuff, because my grandparents lived in a pretty decent sized house in a very quiet neighborhood. So she was pretty much on her own, and that was pretty, that was hard for her. And my grandmother also didn't, I guess the easiest way to put it is to say that my grandmother and my mom just had such different life experiences. My grandmother on my dad's side was a Depression era person, along with my grandfather, wonderful people, but just couldn't have been more different than my mom, who was from Brazil and from like full life and like family and like all this kind of stuff, whereas my American side was kind of the typical, you know, not a lot of talking and stuff, and very kind of tight-lipped when it came to anything that one would expect in terms of the expression of emotion, I guess you could say. Long story short, my mom decided to go back to Brazil, but not with my dad. And we don't really know exactly what happened, but she ended up dying. And my family said it was suicide, but it's not really for sure whether it was accident, murder, or suicide.
Wow.
So, anyhow, that happened, and then I grew up, and my dad, it was very painful for my dad, and he never talked about it with me that I can recall. And then there was one day when I was like 15, 14, or maybe 16, I don't know which, a letter showed up, and I opened it, and it said, you know, like, hi, this is your cousin and your aunt from Brazil and stuff like this, talking about how they were going to be visiting and all this kind of stuff. And so I didn't know what to make out of it. I didn't really understand what was going on, and so I left it for my dad to find, and then I never heard anything about it. He didn't, I don't know what he did or did not do, but he didn't tell me anything about it. And then the only time I actually was consciously aware that I was even from Brazil was when we went on a vacation. My two cousins on my dad's side, so my uncle's two sons, we went to their family in France. Mm-hmm. And I had to get a new passport. The passport that I had was me as a baby, and it said born in Rio de Janeiro. That was the first time I'd ever seen it when I was 16. And so then I was like, huh, what's that about? And so then it's kind of started this process of me discovering that I was from Brazil. I didn't really understand. I had no conscious, any memory that I can recall about it. Mm-hmm. Occasionally I would find like a Polaroid photo of my mom, rarely, in a drawer somewhere in our house. It was just very painful for my dad, and I think he was, you know, pretty devastated when she died. And when I got to college, I started getting into like bossa nova and the guitar. I started learning to play guitar, and I was playing bossa nova, and I was really into that. And I figured, like, you know what, one of these days I'm gonna go back to Brazil and I'm gonna find my family. And I was thinking there'd be like, you know, two people that maybe knew who I was, you know, and whatever. I'd have to like jog their memory and show them pictures and stuff like that. Little did I know that my family had been celebrating my birthday. Wow. And like I was part of their Christmases and like all that kind of stuff for every year that I was alive. Then I had no idea. So what ended up happening is while I was in college, my cousin from Bahia went to go study at NYU, and she's a super sleuth when it comes to anything, internet and whatever.
Yeah.
She found me one day. She called me and like said, "Hey, I'm in New York. I'm your cousin Isabel, and you know, I'd love to meet you and stuff." So I think not long after that, I was just like, okay, that's it. I'm going.
Yeah.
So I'm going to New York. And I get off the plane and we hung out in New York and Manhattan where she was at and everything like that. And it was awesome. For me, I liken it to like if you had a glass and it was half full of my identity. Mm-hmm. And then somebody filled it up.
Yeah.
And it's just changed my life forever.
You just filled in these blanks that have been blank for the longest time.
And I had already started Capoeira at that time.
Mm-hmm. When did you start that?
I started in 1998.
Well, where did you
start that? With Mestre Corleone and Messiha in Berkeley, California. They just opened their school, the Capoeira Arts Cafe. They had been teaching at another location for a while, but they just opened this facility, which is a really cool place. Mm-hmm. And so I was like maybe a year or some change in at that time because I was like, hey, this is fun. You know, I always wanted to do martial art. Oh, it's Brazilian. It's so cool. You know, like, and I just was soaking it up. And I lived there the first 3 years that I trained. I was training like 6 days a week, 3 hours a day. And every free second of school that I wasn't doing school, I was there. Mm-hmm. And then when I Messi Corleone and Messi Han planned a trip to Brazil, a group trip for the Capoeiristas, and that was the first time I came back to Brazil and met my family. Messi Han was there when I met my family in Bahia.
Oh, wow.
And he was there when I met my family in Rio. Mm-hmm. And, like, it was just, man. And then I stayed after that trip and was with my family and stuff, and it was just, it just changed my life for the better forever. Capoeira has always been a part of that, so it's pretty cool. They say my family says I'm more baiano than they are, even though my family's from
because of capoeira.
I play birimbau, I do capoeira, I play the atabaque, and I sing and I do all that kind of stuff. They say I'm more baiano than they are.
Would you say you found capoeira first before your family?
Yeah,
and then that kind of just started mixing up.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. Yeah, because I played Tekken. And my character was like Eddie Gordo. I had heard about this at this for Brazilian. This is Brazilian martial art or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I was playing Tekken and I was playing Eddie Gordo every chance I could at my friend Jerry's house in college. When I was at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. And then they opened up the Capoeira Arts Cafe. And then not long after that, my cousin gets in touch. And then like just started like one thing just kept filing in right after the other.
I kind of want to know about how Capoeira was like. What year did you exactly start Capoeira?
98.
It was 98. So that was before. That was like maybe what like it's kind of like internet was starting.
Yeah.
Do you think like even websites about Capoeira were starting?
Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah, they had that.
Like it started spreading.
The big deal was is like maybe we could get our website and they would like play a song when you landed on it. That was a Capoeira song. That was like the big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you think it was, like, I know that, like, with time as it passes by, like, Capoeira, the way it's kind of carried over is different. Like, now I think it's very online, it's, like, interactive. Like, anyone from the country can now Skype.
Yeah.
Like, people can even Skype. Like, say I'm in, like, Wisconsin. I don't know, like, what country or what state doesn't have Capoeira, but it's, like, now I can Skype, be part of a school, and, you know, get the move-ins down. But how do you think the dynamic was back in, like, 98? In Northern California when you started Capoeira?
I didn't have any reference other than I had three masteries under one roof. Mm-hmm. So I was like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I had Messi Cordillon, who's like, you know, student of Messi, being by Messi Han, who was a student of Messi Suasuna, as well as others down in Brazil. And then we had Messi Sueli, who's the first American woman to be a maestra. And like, man, I mean, we had it. And then he would do his bachizados and he'd bring all these people in, and like, it was just this whole... I mean, I feel like I got, like, one of the luckiest starts you could ask for.
How did you find it?
Okay. Well, besides Eddie Gordo and Tekken, literally I found Messi Cordillon school because I used to park. There was a gym I worked out at, and the parking garage was down the street. And so Messi Cordillon opened up his Capoeira Arts Cafe in between the parking garage and that gym. So I would park, and then one day I was walking, they were having their first bachizado in the space.
Oh, wow.
And I walked in, my whole body lit up with goosebumps. When I saw what it was, I was like, this is that thing. And so then I found the office, I found the information, and that following Monday I was there, and then that was 98, and that's been whatever. I've trained Capoeira without any pause since then.
What do you think is, like, I love to hear about this whenever I talk to different people from different schools. What do you think is, like, your, like, rice and beans of the school? Like,
Wait, who?
Well, I mean, in terms of the school, and then we'll talk about first the school and then you.
What do you mean when you say the school?
Rice and beans, I mean, like, signature, like, do you guys have any signature moves, like, some sort of a way you Jenga? It's like when you go to other schools or bachizados, you can tell the way a person Jenga is, like, kind of, like, what school they're from.
Okay, sure. Yeah, sure. Okay, I know what you mean. I would honestly say that for us, well, Messi Cordillon's goal in a lot of ways that we feel we understand is when we have, like, our style is the lack thereof.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean?
We have, like, everybody's different in our school. We don't have somebody who's necessarily going to be, we're not trying to fit a mold.
Mm-hmm.
We're not all trying to, like, we have, Messi Cordillon has always said, I have a lot of suggestions, you can take them or leave them.
Mm-hmm.
They're good suggestions. But he's never been one to say, like, okay, you're going to put your this there, your arm there when you do that, and your hand needs to be just like that, or like whatever. So, I think I mean, I would honestly say, like, our style is the lack thereof. I look at the way people play in our school, and it's like, it's all crap. This is so different. There's so many different ways that people do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one thing. What I found out after, as I got older in Capoeira, is that I found out that they, like, really would, you know, argue it out about, like, what they wanted to do and all that kind of stuff, and the direction that they wanted things to go in.
Mm-hmm.
And but Messi Cordillon kind of made the final decisions on stuff, and then as a student at the time, never would have guessed.
Oh, really?
Never would have guessed.
I guess
they seemed like they were on the same page, and we were always going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But Messi Cordillon's style also is one of, this is what we're doing now, and now we're doing that, and tomorrow we're going to do the other thing, you know, and it's just always changing, you know.
Would it be would you say it's contemporary?
Messi Cordillon comes from a time before all that.
Okay.
So, we play, he always said that, what I feel is an accurate assessment of what he's looking for is to be able to play beating ball, play capoeira according to the rhythm of the beating ball.
Okay.
So if it's Angola, you can play Angola. If it's regional, you can play on regional, Banguela, Samento Grande de Angola, Yuna, Miudinho, we did that for a while. Like when Messi Han was there and he was really curious about what was going on with Messi Sousa and Miudinho, we were doing that for a while. You know, so we were doing a lot of stuff.
I think that's our signature. We have this intellectual prize criteria. It just fits in anywhere.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Yeah, cheers. That sounds good. I'll take it.
When did you start to figure that you're like, I want to do this, I want to become a teacher, and I want to teach?
If I'm brutally honest, probably like day three.
Wow.
But of course, you can't say that.
Yeah.
At the time, it's been like, who the hell do you think you are? But then when I went all in, like, legit, of, like, doing capoeira as my main focus for, like, profession and all that kind of stuff, that was, like, 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
6 years ago now, probably. Yeah. 2009 or 10, I forget which.
Like, what was the trigger of that?
My uncle passed away in Brazil. One of my uncles. And I just felt like any job that I had where I wasn't my own boss, because I was working in different industries and doing well and all that kind of stuff, but my time wasn't mine, and if I wanted to go to Brazil and visit my family or whatever, I had to, like, you know, ask. And I, when he passed away, I was, like, you know, on the other side of the world, and I just really felt sad about that, and I said, like, I need to figure out how, and I'm still working on it, but I'm figure out how I can be traveling to Brazil on a regular basis, seeing my family there and my family here in California, and not feel like somebody is looking at me sideways, you know, out the side, and going to have something to say about it. Like, I have to find that thing that makes it possible for me to do that and be trying to bridge that distance as much as I can.
Were you already in LA at that time?
Yeah.
What brought you to L.A.?
I wanted to be an actor. I studied, I have a Master of Fine Arts in Dramatic Art, and I have a Bachelor of Science in Integrated Biology from UC Berkeley. So
it's funny because, like, my birthday, like, a couple months ago, I was sick, so I didn't even celebrate my birthday, but I went on this massive,
everybody's,
like,
getting sick right now.
I went on this massive Netflix binge, and I found you.
What?
Yeah.
Get out.
No, you were, like, in my favorite Grey's Anatomy episode. Oh, do you remember that episode? I was bawling. I was bawling. Like, I watched the first time, and then I watched it, and I was like, oh, wait. Like, I was kind of, like, tearing out. I was like, oh, my God. Like, this girl got...
Yep.
Do you remember that episode?
Like, I sure do.
She got, like, what was it, like, a railroad or something like
that? She had, like,
that,
a pipe through her and another dude.
Yeah. And then the dude lived, and then I was like, oh, my God, but
she
where's
the
she
had to make
the
choice, and she chose, live. And then they told me I was sad. It was really weird.
I was tripping out.
That was a very interesting experience. It was cool. That was when that show was, like, just coming on.
Like, everyone started to...
Yeah, people were just... They were just... And I was there, and it was very clear that they were just realizing, like, hey, this is catching on.
Yeah.
And it was back also when that guy, Isaiah Washington, was on the show, and then, you know, mouthed off and said something, I don't know what, that made him get fired. And he was, like, super aloof. But then, you know, McDreamy...
Yeah.
What's his name?
Patrick Dempsey.
Patrick Dempsey was, like, you know, I had a scene with him. And so he was, like, you know... talking to me and giving me pointers and all that kind of stuff. And then and then I had I talked to Ellen Pompeo a little bit, but nothing to write home about. I think I'm such a moron because I was so focused on trying to do a good job for, like, my part, which is this little bit, whatever. And the producer comes up to me. I wasn't Shonda Rhimes, but it was some other producer, this woman. She's like, oh my God, your audition was so great. And I'm, like, so focused and such a moron that I was like, oh, I didn't know you were there. That's nice. Oh, cool. And she was like, people are kind of, I don't know. I don't know what she was looking for, but I know that I botched whatever opportunity I may have gotten out of that to, like, maybe, like, create a relationship there that might have been beneficial. But it was a trip. That it was a lot of fun, and I met my wife for, like, you know, 30 seconds.
You did?
Yeah, yeah.
What was she doing?
She was stuck to the dude, you know, like, in between takes. They just had to sit there all the dang time. You know, they're stuck with all the prosthetic and everything, and the pipe, you know?
Yeah. So,
she's like, hi. I was like, hi, I'm really sorry you're dying. She's like, I am too. We had such potential.
So good. I was like,
and then Patrick Dempsey was all like, right before it was like, we were doing his part of it, you know, blah, 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 all the takes that were on his side of it. And then we go to my part. He's like, all right, here's the money shot. And I was just like, you trying to psych me out, Jack? Like, what are you doing, man? I'm supposed to get a little teary over here. You trying to mess me up. But they gave me, like, a trailer. I had, like, a little part of a trailer. But it was cool. I mean, it was a very interesting experience. It's remarkable how much goes into making that. I mean, like, the sheer manpower, energy, creativity. Like, the other thing about that blew my mind was, like, Patrick Dempsey had a dude dedicated to his hair.
Just his hair.
That's it.
It's important.
Every take, He checked in with homeboy who made sure his hair was just right. And every it was the ritual of everything. He'd go and like dude would fix it and then he would go. Cut.
Come back.
Fix it. Then he'd go. Like, I mean, it's a trip. And that's just one minute example of the sheer, I mean, like, there's just all these people. They were cooking up. They were like, oh, somebody came in. I don't remember who, one of the people that was, like, one of the stars or whatever. Was like, hey, there's, like, some paparazzi outside or something like that. And then Ellen Pompeo and Patrick Dempsey were like, we should go out and kiss. So they'll think there's, like, on set romance or something. Like, you know, like, trying to make the show more popular and stuff like that. It was really interesting.
And that was, like, 2005.
Sure.
Something
sounds
like
great.
That. Yeah, okay. Or something. So it was like such a long time ago.
Yeah, it was another life.
So that was when you were an actor, so you're not acting anymore.
No, not anymore.
So it's just Capoeira now.
Yeah.
I'm just, like, knowing about your story and stuff like that, what kind of goals do you go into when you're finally advanced? Because I know when you're a student, it's like, you're ramping up, I want to do this, I want to do that, how do you stay so focused when you're teaching at the same time?
You need an emotionally broken psyche.
Really?
No, I mean, I don't know.
I was like, I'm intrigued. I want to hear about it.
First of all, I think motivation comes from within, right? So for me, every time I do capoeira, every time I do anything like that, I feel like I'm that much closer to my family. Mm-hmm. My mom, I found out later in life, like, that my mom, she used to date a capoeirista and loved capoeira. Like, thought it was so cool. I was trying to, like, connect the dots for a while. I was like, ooh, maybe she, like, knew Messi Corleone. They went to the same school in Bahia and in college. And, like, maybe they knew each other. They studied in the same, you know, they both studied business administration. So it's like, He was like, I asked him, he was like, He couldn't connect the dots. So, like, whatever. And I was like, maybe she dated Messi Corleone. But, you know, like, that didn't happen. But, so for me, like, that's my main thing. And I like being physically active. Mm-hmm. And I like taking care of myself and that, being healthy and all that stuff. So, like, I have this, I also have done just like all kinds of stuff. I played all team sports you can think of growing up in the U.S. I played all those. And then I did a bunch of individual sports on a competitive level also. I've gone from endurance to contact to collision sports to extreme sports. And then I arrived at capoeira and I realized I'd always wanted to do like a martial art. But then I also love the fact that there's the music and the expression and the people coming together and creating the energy, that the community, the ashe and all that. And it was just, for me, it just doesn't get boring.
What came first in capoeira to you? To me,
nothing. I suck at everything. Everything I do is function of hard work.
I just feel like the mental stuff of, like, the community came later.
What came to me is like seeing other awesome students was just like, oh my gosh, man. And then, like, my masteries, the way they did music and everything like that, and the vibe and everything was so just good for me. I also agreed with them, like, in their perspective. It just jived with how I saw things.
And what was that?
Just, I mean, that's hard to articulate. Messer Corleone kind of has, like, a hands-off approach in a lot of ways, which is another sort of, like, if there was a style that we have in terms of the teaching, is that it's not, it's vague, right? That's fair to say, okay, right? There's a disciplined and conscious, vague approach to teaching students to force them to want to figure out how they learn.
Like, can you give me an example?
Like, if you ask me a question, I would say it depends. Why don't you go ask?
Yep, that's
someone.
Look on the internet, ask some people, come back, and maybe I'll answer your question then.
No, it's true. It's like when you think you haven't figured out.
How do I do this movement? I don't know. You tell me. What do you want to do? You know? I don't give a lot of straight answers, and I learned that's like sort of it's sort of a take on the Socratic method. Would be fair to say?
Yeah. Sort of question on the question.
Yeah. So it's forced. Messer Corleone says that if you provide too many answers, you take away the student's capacity to learn how they learn.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think that's awesome because I without having realized that was a thing, now that I've had more time in capoeira, I know that then now I've heard him say that and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've realized that there have been things that I do and I was like, yes, I know how I learn. I can go learn. and I know effectively what I need in order to learn. You know? What, so like I'm self-sufficient more so in that way.
What kind of goals are you working on now between of yourself?
Not sucking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's like something everyone wrestles with every year.
The avoidance of the suck.
The
avoidance of the suck, yeah. No, but I think in terms of what I'm working on, I'm very curious about a few things right now. We've kind of arrived through some interesting sort of classes and stuff that we'd have taught and been a part of over the years, where I'm trying to unlock the body's potential to be dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And doing that easily. So some people are blessed with athletic talent.
Mm-hmm.
I am not one of them. And some people don't feel like their body is heavy. I am not one of them. But I've started to figure out tricks to how I train that all of a sudden my body starts to feel light and fast where it didn't before.
Like what kind of exercises?
I'm trying to take my Pulu Lugatu right now. No, I've been doing stuff like today on Saturdays. What I usually do is I put on a 30-pound weight vest and 33-pound ankle weights
mm-hmm.
on each one, and I do a bunch of movements. Very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you can't do crazy stuff with that weight because it'll
right.
mess you up. Injury is a real thing that can happen. So I stay simple,
mm-hmm.
and I do stuff with that. But it's remarkable what happens when you take it off.
Yeah, you feel so much lighter.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I've been working a lot with that. And, I'm very interested to see where that goes, because as I get older, I've always said that I'm playing the long game.
Mm-hmm.
And people can jump and do all this kind of great stuff. That's awesome, but I'm not trying to get in line for Advil. So,
yes.
I want to be playing and enjoying capoeira, Messi Lovano is in his 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And he's playing great capoeira. You know, and it's
for
just
sure.
like, wow, man, I want to be like that. You know, I don't want there to be like an expiration date on me.
Yeah.
You know, I want to play like Mr. Corleone's in, he's 70 and he was hurt for a while and now he's playing more capoeira than he was before. It's just like, dang, man, this is awesome. You know, like I'm trying to be like that. So if I have a goal is to, I tell my students, what do I say about the fire in the, remember that? Every student, every capoeirista has like a fire, like a pilot light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a flame that burns. And that's their interest, inspiration, desire, motivation to do capoeira in some capacity, whatever that is. The thing is, they're the only, that individual student is also the only person that can maintain that fire.
Yeah.
There is absolutely. Nothing that a teacher can do. There is nothing that another friend in capoeira can do
mm-hmm.
to maintain that flame. So you have to figure out what you need to keep that flame burning so that then you can keep doing it without getting like burned out,
mm-hmm.
turned off, or crash and burn, or whatever, you know? So like I'm always looking for that stuff.
I feel like there's a lot of like plateaus and
normal.
Like, no, not for you?
No, normal. 100% normal.
It's normal, right?
1,000% normal.
What is it something that you do to kind of like get through it? To where you don't quit?
The main thing I recognize is that if I don't plateau, I'm not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of plateaus come from certain physiological responses, like the body has like physically caught up to a point, but then mentally, intellectually is stuck, or neurologically or neuromuscularly is stuck and has to integrate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a like, there's a system of training, for example, that like the U.S. Men's Junior Olympic gymnastics team uses where
mm-hmm.
they very specifically go through. The coach, I read his book, he said that if you see like a dude doing like the Iron Cross, you know, that's like a super impressive move, you know,
mm-hmm.
like crazy strong to be able to pull that off. And he said like you might think, I don't know what you think you're seeing when you're watching that. But I know what I'm seeing when I'm watching that. And it is decades of commitment to get to that point. Persistence, day in, day out, millimeter by half millimeter improvement to get to that place.
Mm-hmm.
So he talked about how there's like sort of three stages to shall we say, athletic development. Mm-hmm. So if you start doing something new, your body is going to immediately start, you know, at like point A, and it's going to then start to recruit all of its available assets to get better at whatever you're trying to do from point A through the first like 2 to 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that means that it's going to get more efficient with its neuromuscular connections, so that you'll be stronger with the musculature you have, the whatever coordination is available to you, all those things are going to, like, the body's just going to, like, essentially, it's like busting out the duct tape to try and, like, fix everything so that immediately we can at least get going. Mm-hmm. But then what happens, and this is usually when plateau starts to kick in, is there's about a month of where you actually have to grow, or sometimes 6 weeks or 8 weeks, mm-hmm. of where you actually have to grow new muscle. So then that occurs. And so that's where people will feel like 2 weeks, you're like, wow, 2-4 weeks, whoa, I'm slowly making it happen. And then the next like slog of like 4 to 8 weeks, that's when you're plateauing, because you're not seeing the gains, the growth, the push mm-hmm. forward and all that kind of stuff. But your body is essentially like contracted out. You know, they went and found some construction crew and they're like, okay, here's the plans. Let's go. We got to lay the foundation, build the walls, do all that kind of stuff. Boom, boom, boom. It's all the stuff that's not glamorous, right? And then after that, there's an integration period where neuromuscularly, mentally, you then need to get as efficient as you were before the second phase with the new muscle. So then you'll see new improvement again. And then, boom, you're in a whole new place and you break out of the plateau. So what do you say, if I say to someone who's plateauing, I'm like, good, you mm-hmm. should plateau. You need the plateau, because it's not going to be a linear march over time. Mm-hmm. It will be if you zoom way out. It's like the stock market. Like if you look at a stock market graph and you look at like one day, 20, like 12 hours, whatever, how many hours they're open, it might go all over the place in that one day. Mm-hmm. You zoom out a week, it might look like it's going up and then back down. You zoom out a month, you zoom out a year, you zoom out 5, 10, 15 years, and all of a sudden you see a steady line of growth. But the individual day in and day out is going to be up and down, 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 plateau, up and down. But then long view, lots of growth. So anybody who's plateauing, good. You need the plateau.
How many students would you say you have under you?
Adults and kids, 60, 70, something like that.
60, 70, wow.
Adults and kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, like, students is like somebody who walks in the door at least once a week mm-hmm. or something like that. You know, that doesn't mean that I've got like 70, like,
at once.
Deep, you know, 6 days a week. You know, no, but like, yeah, and the whole crew, if I bring everybody into the fold, yeah, it's probably like 60, 70, something like that.
How do you think your teaching has changed from 10 years ago, is it, when you... Sorry, how do you think it's grown since the 10 years up until now?
It's mostly communication. Mm-hmm. Figuring out better and better ways to say something that's intelligent, shut up when it's necessary, mm-hmm. Get out of the student's way, and try and mostly... Sometimes I wonder how much a teacher even does. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I ask my teachers about this. I'm like, well, you know, what do you think we even do? You know, like... Because there are people that will walk in the door. Like, my wife is an excellent example. You know, she's a couple of weeks still a long time. She also did gymnastics 4 to 6 hours a day from, like, the age of, like, 4 to, like, 16. Mm-hmm. So, like, then transitioning to something like capoeira was, like, a breeze for her physically. Mm-hmm. You know, because she can already do everything that any hotshot capoeirista acrobat can do.
Right.
She did when she was 14. She sees that and she's like, meh.
Yeah.
You can point your toes. You know, like, your legs are bent. You know, like, she looks at it and she's like, eh. But, so, I mean, what did her capoeira teacher do? Mm-hmm. You know, like, she physically came in at such a high level. Mm-hmm. Like, what did her teacher do? Showed her how to jenga. These are the kicks. Realistically, what I think the teacher does is keep the student interested. Mm-hmm. As best they can, by providing a positive, fun, and hopefully in the right ways, challenging environment as the student progresses. my teachers have said things like, pay more attention to new students and ignore older students. New students, you put your time there, demand more of your older students and pay less attention to them. Force them to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Force them to develop their self-motivation, and if they don't want them, chow. You know, see you later.
Yeah.
Other people, like, I try to take that and then also kind of marry where I feel like is sort of LA culture and my students, their vibe and stuff like that, and find a way to keep people having fun. I think the mostly the thing is more, and there's so many different ways to have fun in Capoeira, which is great, but I think the main thing is, I mean, why do we even show up? Why does the student walk in the door the first time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do they then come back the second time? And then why do they come back the 50, 70, 100, blah, blah, blah? For me, I think it's because they want to enjoy themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and think of the other benefits that all come along for it are awesome. But the physical ones, the community, all these things, they're awesome. So I think my job is to just meet those expectations of the initial expectation,
mm-hmm.
and remember those as often as I can, and try to keep that standard high, and or try and exceed it for myself. So, I mean, I am lucky in that, you know, we come from the methodology of Messy Bimba, so I have a proven methodology, decades old, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of capoeiristas proven methodology of teaching capoeira. Like, we have that. So,
mm-hmm.
What do I need to reinvent? I don't need to do anything. I'm not going to try and reinvent the wheel. So, it's mostly, like, how... And I'm not physically that talented, like, as a capoeirista. I'm not. I remember asking my teacher that. I asked Messi Acordeon. I was like, but Messi, you know? Then I asked Messi, huh, too. I was like, you know, I'm not... I'm like, you know, I'm like, great. There's guys that are way better than me. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, like, it's not about that. It's about, like, a certain level of charisma,
mm-hmm.
and the capacity to... you know, engage with the students and keep them feeling like they're maybe a part of something, or that they're... Bottom line, I think people need to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my main thing, is to try and figure out how they have fun through capoeira.
You're the only UCA in LA, right?
Correct.
How is it... do you keep in touch a lot with up north? Like, do you go up north a lot and
try
kind of, like, check in and say, this message is what we're doing, what should we do more?
I call my teachers a lot,
mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to call other folks in UCA more. Like, you know, Messi Corleone says, like, I'm his alarm clock, except he's already up. But I always call him, like, the same message, huh, the same thing. They know
mm-hmm.
my schedule. They know, like, oh, you're walking the dog, huh? You walking the dog? Like, yeah, hey, how's it going, Messi? You know, like, so I always call them. I try to talk to them, like, once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And because also they're nice people, you know, and like I really enjoy having them in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that I think is also wonderful about capoeira, is I've met a lot of really wonderful people, and you know, the capacity to have those relationships. I don't know. I think I was taking them for granted for a long time, and then all of a sudden you realize it's like, if I really make the effort to, you know, build a bridge here, and I want to do that more with more people. That's kind of one of my New Year's resolutions, is more of that within my UCA crew, and then others as well around here in LA. Yeah, just to not feel it, you feel less lonely, because being a teacher can feel real lonely at times. So
what do you think sets apart the LA school from up north? Is there anything?
Geographical.
Okay. I feel like there's a different dynamic of North and South California.
Oh, you think? Oh, well, they hate us down here. They just played hate us. Like, I mean, anybody from NorCal hates SoCal, period, end of story. Like,
oh, do you think that?
You walk in the door, you're going to catch your fair share of shit.
Like, do you think that's...
Of course it's true. It's a pastime up there to hate on LA.
In terms of capoeira, though, I feel like there's a different dynamic.
What do you think it is?
You know, unfortunately, I have not been to NorCal in a while, but I feel like it's so condensed up there because it's...
I would say where it's equally so here. There's so much capoeira and so...
Yeah.
There's tons.
It's but great. I feel like it's... Every little school has, like, a different thing that I can pick up.
There?
No, in every school, yeah. I'm saying when I visit.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, there's always going to be, like, the culture of the place, right? I mean, every place is going to do things the way they do and have their... This is and that's that they feel like their ways and means of, like, we like this, we don't do that, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's always going to be the case. That's just the way people are.
Mm-hmm.
Can't help it.
So you have an app on iTunes, and is it the Google Store also? Is it also
working on it? Getting there, not yet. Okay. But yes, iOS for Apple is
just fine because I have
the App Store.
It's great. I have an iPhone, so I'm excited.
I wish that more people did, because every time I say...
It's so easy.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, don't get me wrong. All that's awesome, but there's a lot of people with Android that so we're scrambling to try and get the Android one going, too.
When were you like, we need a music service?
A lot of years ago. I want to say like maybe 2008 or 9.
Mm-hmm. And like, how did this... Yeah, I want to know everything, like how it started.
Well, I just figured somebody... I mean, you know, at that time... downloading and purchasing a song and such on through iTunes or whatever other channel you might have used at that time, you know, was becoming popular. And also I saw how students, myself included, I've always been a fan of music,
mm-hmm.
popular music. And I saw how it was difficult to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also like, now that you could like experiment with music, you could listen to it beforehand. And I saw that people were less and less interested in buying a CD that they couldn't listen to ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Also, people, it's kind of a hassle. It was, it still is. It's a lot of steps you have to go through to take a CD and then rip it to your computer and then dump it into your iTunes or whatever application of your choice. And then hardline in your cell phone or
mm-hmm.
iPod or whatever, and then
mm-hmm.
upload it to that, and then on top of that, once it got there were always spelling issues, or like then you realize that the metadata that was like on the CD is like non-existent.
Yeah.
And so like all of a sudden you've got this CD you just bought
track
that says
one,
like track 1 through 13.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, what is that?
I remember
that.
Yeah.
You know, so all those things kind of let, and then on top of that, seeing Mestre Corleone, you know, work so hard in the studio. I've been in the studio with him before. And see how hard he would work, you know, to produce an album and everything that would go into, like, trying to sell it and everything, like, around that and other Amasities, too. And then because of the kind of events that he would have with his Bosch's albums and stuff, helping with the Amasities try and sell things. And then when the financial kind of crisis hit in 2008, how that all just, like, stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And then also combined that people didn't carry cash the same way, people
yeah.
had cards more often, and everything was cash based at these events and stuff. And then all of a sudden people stopped bringing CDs because
mm-hmm.
they didn't think anybody wanted them, they didn't think they'd sell or whatever. All these things just at a point made me go, like 2008 or 9, I was like, somebody's got to do like an iTunes thing for Capoeira. I kept thinking somebody would, years go by, blah blah blah. 2011 I was just like, F it, I'm doing it. Fine. Nobody
yeah.
wants to do it. I'm going to do it. And so then that's when that started. And we built a website first where you could, and still can, go www.dundak.com, D-U-N-D-A-K.com. You can go there and you can download, purchase music and download it. But then after that was up and running and all that kind of stuff, then I was showing it to my family in Brazil and my cousin who's a freaking cardiologist,
mm-hmm.
intelligent guy, super cool, couldn't figure out how to use it, and I was just like, damn it! Because it's not like it's hard, it's because at that time, apps were coming on, and like,
mm-hmm.
you open up your phone, you touch the screen in one place, there, boom, you've got music at your fingertips. Like, there,
mm-hmm.
even the steps, we didn't resolve the number of steps that there were. We just made a place where at least people could go. But
mm-hmm.
still, there were a ton of steps because you buy it from us and then you download it to your computer and then you upload it to your application like iTunes or whatever and
mm-hmm.
then you hardline your phone in, dump it into your phone. At least we got cleaned up on all the metadata and like all that kind of stuff. That all works nicely now. But still, it doesn't compete to, oh, hey, there's an app, download. Oh, there it is on my phone now. Open,
mm-hmm.
run. Like, that's so fast and easy. So I realized... not long after having built the website, I was like, we gotta have an app. And so, and then thankfully, when we first started the project, me and some other people that I was starting it with, I was like, we need to be in, you know, we need an app, but we couldn't figure out what to do. We didn't know, because they were like, well, iTunes shuts down everything, they don't let other music on there, and like all that. And then Spotify came on the scene, and then Pandora came on the scene,
mm-hmm.
or Pandora, then Spotify, whatever the order is. And so then I started thinking about like what can we do, and then looking into the possibility of the app and the way various internet and like server based architecture, what's available now, I realized that maybe we could do it. And
mm-hmm.
so I found through Conte Messi Barral, my good friend, one of his students is an iOS developer.
Wow.
So I've been trying to keep it in the Capoeira family, part of the work, I mean, much of the work as I can, that make me is practical. And he's awesome. Camarão is the man. So he and I have been working on the iOS one, and then we finally got it up and running and up to the iTunes App Store. And it's there. And it, now it's no longer purchase of like an individual album. Now it's like $3.99 a month, US dollars. You can listen to whatever you want. All our whole collection is there. And the masters, that was the other thing too, is I knew for a long time that the artist would receive next to nothing.
Yeah, how does that work?
So it's 70% of every single cent, dollar, whatever you want to pick for a denomination, 70% of that goes to the artist.
Wow.
So there is actually nothing like that in the music industry right now. Nobody gets that lion's share like that. There's nothing. Except for maybe a couple of... But my point is that there's so many... Usually there's so many other people in between point of sale and whatever piece the artist is supposed to get, that what the artist usually ends up with is like much less than that. But my goal has always been to put the artist first, so that's our goal.
Now that you're onto the iTunes store and you're trying to get it for Android, is there anything that you kind of want to transform it into more than that?
Oh yeah, I got lots of phases for it. Phase one is the music. I don't know the order of these yet, but like I want to include... everybody asked me for lyrics, so that's coming eventually. We'll get the lyrics on there. And I got ideas about how we can do that and hopefully have it be really fun. But then for me, like what I would call like a legit phase two would be to include like text so that your monthly, you pay for it. And then like the teachers, they want to write whatever they want to write. And they feel like they want to distribute it to people and stuff like that. They'll have a way to platform to do that through the app.
Yeah.
Then video, that's like phase three. So like if they want to make videos and stuff like that, and part of your subscription gets you access to that. And all of these then would also, like if they write, if they make music, if they make videos, that all is just revenue generation for the artist. So like there's ways that they can, they'll always be the same 70-30 split at least that they'll benefit from. And then I also, hopefully we can get to it if the people like it and we get, and we're able to, you know, have the revenue come in that allows us to then invest back into developing. I'd like to also do all those three phases and then also physical sale of physical products. So like you could just basically, my goal is to make it like the Swiss Army knife for a capoeirista in the digital space. Like you open it up, it's like, whoa, this mastery is, I love their music. Whoa, they got a book. Oh, that's so cool. Look at all their tutorial videos. Awesome. Oh, I want a t-shirt. Yeah, boom. You know,
should be like the Amazon of capoeira.
Sure, fine, sounds good. That kind of thing,
right?
And then if I had it my way, like my real like moonshot is even to build like payment processing and money transfer into that, so that then I wouldn't have, then the masters could like send money to Brazil, or I could send, you know, all that kind of stuff. I could send it to them. I could do all that and not have to charge them service fees for it.
Instead of being the middleman.
Yeah. Just like cutting. Like if maybe that's a moonshot part of it, but if it could work, that'd be awesome.
I guess what I would like to know is, what do you think, like your goal, or in terms of what you hope for your school in LA right now with UCA would be?
Well, right now, we've been having, 2015 was actually really challenging, and apparently it was really challenging for a lot of people that teach capoeira. For whatever reason, I can't say for everybody, but a lot of people that I talked to, 2015 was a challenging year. 2016 is already off to a much better start, and I've been hearing that even internationally. The people I talked to through Dundack all over the world have said similar things. It's really interesting. I don't know what's going on, but it's apparently improving also. So my goal for my school in the short, medium, and long term is just, I'd like a little bit more students, because there's certain things that I think would be fun to be able to do. My goal, pipe dream, if I had numbers and stuff like that, I'd like to get to 100 students. That'd be cool. I'd really like that. My biggest goal as a person teaching capoeira is to show that it can be done and you can live off it and have a nice life. I'm not talking about like, you know, driving up, you know, a 500 SL Benz or anything like that. I don't even care about that, but I never did. But I'd like to be able to, you know, have a family and have a house and have options in life, you know, as a result of teaching capoeira. That'd be great. I see it in a lot of other realms, So there's some stuff in the works that I'm not going to talk about because I don't want to jinx. That could be really good. That might help realize that this year. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's the goals right now.
Okay, and where can we find you? Website, Instagram, Twitter.
Website. First of all, if you don't like copying down a URL, you can just type in Capoeira and Los Angeles, and we'll be there. The United Capoeira Association, Los Angeles. Type in Capoeira Silver Lake. Type in Capoeira Atwater Village. Type in Capoeira Glendale. You'll find us all that way. But the URL itself, www.capoeiraucainla.com. Capoeira, UCANLA.com. And then Twitter, you can find me at Guatambu CANLA. Like, I was so clever, and I was like, oh, there's two U's. I'll use them for each. Aren't I nifty and smart? Guatambu CANLA. That's my handle on Twitter. I got Instagram. I got on there early and then never did anything with it, but now I'm doing more with it, and you can just find me at Guatambu on Instagram, the grams. And then Facebook, just search Guatambu, and you'll find me. If you search Guatambu Los Angeles or Michael Guatambu, and then United Capoeira Association Los Angeles on Facebook, just look for us there. You can find us. And then my Instagram and my Twitter are essentially those for the school as well.
And then for Dundalk.
Oh, and then Dundalk, the URL, www.dundalk.com. Dundalk is spelled DUNDAK.com. And you just search Dundalk on right now, Apple's App Store will be one of the first hits you'll find as you get to DUND. Dundalk will come right up. And please download it. There's a 15-day free trial where you can listen to everything, no limitations. And then at the end of that, it's just $3.99 a month. And all in-app purchase and everything is super simple. So please, the more of that happens, I can't even tell you how much it will help these teachers that have worked so hard and continue to work hard all the time. I can't even tell you how incredible the opportunity would be for everyone involved if Dundalk works. It's like, it has the potential to do so much good and so much positive change, and everybody, it's a total win-win for everyone. The, you know, tide raising all boats at the same time.
Thank you so much for doing this for me.
Yeah, you got it. No problem. Esperta.
Thank you.